From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of unusual stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And today on the program, Running Away. In both of the stories on this episode, there's a moment that feels like the most impassable of dead ends, like there's no way to possibly keep going. But then somehow there is a way through, one step in front of another kind of thing. This first story follows one woman's years of perseverance, of relentlessly following the thread of a story that's tangled up with her own high school memories, where she once saw an educational slideshow that was so incredible she couldn't believe it was real, until years later when she found undeniable proof that it was. Just a warning before we begin, this is a really funny story and there's no bad language in it, but it does touch on some pretty adult themes, including sexual assault and violence. From KCRW, it's Unfictional and 8 Pounds of Pressure.
It's 2012, and I'm at a Palm Springs resort with a bunch of girls I take a trip with every year. We all grew up in the same small town and have known each other forever. And over the years on these trips, when we're together, away from our regular lives, something funny happens. And it's like the fumes from our spray tans and hair products and vodka Red Bulls combine together to open up a vortex that allows us to time warp back into any moment of our shared past. And it was during one of these magical moments, when we were all packed into our little hotel room, that I flash back to our 9th grade PE class in our tiny little Washington town, to a time we watched a film strip that I hadn't thought about in 20 years. It's 1994. No one has an email address. Every morning before school, I eat my cereal while watching a taped recording of Nirvana on MTV Unplugged. Then I slip on my jean jacket, spritz myself with some CK1, and head out the door. This is my routine every single day of 9th grade. But on one day, something very out of the ordinary was about to happen.
I remember that we were in 9th grade, and it was like this pullout unit from P.
This is my friend Rachel.
I remember the room was like this weird like closet office.
It was the room where they kept the hockey sticks.
It was like wheeled in a TV on the cart. Yeah, I don't know.
They'd brought us in to watch a mysterious film strip.
Yeah, it's going to be slightly freaky.
Get in here.
The film strip starts, and it's from the 70s. It's the kind where you hear bong, and then the teacher has to advance the film. And this film strip was all about women's self-defense. It starts out normal enough. It shows us how to break a wrist hold if someone tries to grab us in a park, stick to well-lit areas, that sort of thing. But as the film strip went on, we would discover that it also contained the most insane piece of advice that any of us would ever receive. I remember the film strip saying something like this: if you are a woman driving alone and you think someone is following you, you should drive your car into a police station. Not up to the police station, but into the actual building. It was one small piece of my high school education that seems so unusual, so hard to believe. Let's think about this for a second. What if you just crashed your car into the police station, but then the person you thought was following you was just also going to the bank? Was this our lot in life as women? We just had to choose between getting kidnapped or driving ourselves into buildings? Also, am I remembering this correctly? Back in the Palm Springs hotel room, I've had this flashback, and I bring it up to my high school friends like, you guys, did that really happen? And before I can even finish, Sarah, who was a senior when we were freshmen, was like, oh, crash your car into a police station? Yeah, that definitely happened. And then everyone just started talking all at once, like, yes, yes, that absolutely happened. We were all told to crash our cars into buildings, yes. So, ever the champion of nostalgia, I was like, we need to find this on YouTube and watch it tonight. But it wasn't on YouTube. And this is the point when a normal person would just shrug their shoulders and think, oh, well, that was a good laugh. I guess it's just not out there. But I am not a normal person. And my eyes just flashed with fire, and I was like, I will find you. I thought maybe my old high school might have it, so I called the librarian. She's my friend Becky's mom, and her name is Dewey, which is the perfect name for a librarian. She said they had gotten rid of all of their old film strips the year after I graduated, so that option was out. I found a company in Texas called Educational Film Strips, but the woman there said they didn't have any more film strips in their warehouse. 3 more years, and 3 more girl strips go by, and I have nothing to show for it. Until one day, I try a new tactic, and I search intentionally for misspelled words. Type in self-defense with a C instead of an S, and somehow it brings up a WorldCat library record I've never seen before. The Practical Personal Defense for Women film strip. And it says that it's potentially available in the libraries of 14 schools. I spend the next day calling each school one by one, but no one has it on the shelf, until finally, the last school I call says they do have it. It's at a university in Puerto Rico. My boyfriend was like, well, obviously we have to go to Puerto Rico and get it, which is how I knew I would marry him someday. This was the hottest trail I had ever found, and I knew it was also my last chance. It was this or nothing. So a package from Puerto Rico comes in the mail, and I have a film strip in my hands, but I still don't know if it's the film strip. And then I actually can't find a film projector old enough to watch it on. I was way too excited to wait for a projector, so I just took the audio tapes to the music library at the university where I work because I knew that they had a tape player, and here's something weird. The librarian's name is Caitlin, and my name is Caitlin, but she's like in her 70s, and for a second I think, what if she is really me from the future? And this film strip means more to the world than any of us ever suspected. So I sit down and I press play. And I start to hear things I kind of remember. There's that weird, corny production music.
Practical Personal Defense for Women.
The bong in between the slides.
Let's face it. Girls and women today do things alone. No one is willing to stay in the house until they can find a friend to go someplace with them.
Suddenly I'm 14 again, stuffed into that equipment closet in my high school gym.
When walking alone, try to stay in populated areas.
The narrator's voice is so familiar. She's got that precise, authoritative film strip kind of tone.
Walk on the outside of the sidewalk, staying away from doorways and bushes. These are places in which a person could hide and grab you suddenly without attracting much attention.
Where do people even learn to talk like that? And how does someone end up in a film strip like this?
Part two.
It's the driving section.
Safety in walking and driving.
Is this it? Is this it?
Remain calm and remember that your car can be used as a defensive weapon.
I can barely breathe.
Keep it running and keep it moving.
And then?
If you think that the situation is critical, you must seek immediate help. Drive into the police station.
Drive into the police station.
Notice that I said into, not up to, the police station. I don't mean at great speed, less than 5 miles.
Okay, so not at great speeds, but still.
If you merely drive up to the police station, you could be seriously hurt or killed before you could get out of the car.
And it was even better than I remembered, because she goes on to say that if you can't find a police station, you can also crash your car into a 24-hour convenience store.
Once again, drive into the store. You definitely will attract attention quickly.
She also suggests that you can drive around like you're drunk first to attract even more attention.
Drive up on the sidewalk through people's yards. Keep blowing your horn. Do anything that will attract attention and cause people to call the police.
So basically, just swerve around a lot and then crash your car into a police station because you will not get arrested and everyone will totally understand.
Most of these suggestions will end up costing you some money, but at least you will be alive to pay for the damage you may do.
I couldn't wait to share it with my friends. So my boyfriend and I made a digital copy of it and we took it back to my hometown. We had a bunch of screenings where I got to surprise my friends with it.
Women driving alone are actually chased and threatened by boys.
While we were there, we did a little tour of my hometown, and we went to my old high school and saw the gym where we originally watched it. And of course, we went to the police station, which miraculously is still intact, despite the fact that an entire generation of young women was trained to crash into it. Again, this is the point where a normal person would be totally satisfied and just be done with it. But I was not done with it. I had so many more questions. When was this advice ever considered a good idea? Did anyone ever really do it? How did it become part of this film strip? I knew what I had to do.
Here we go.
Hey, personal defense for women.
Bonnie. Veronica Eskridge.
Did you try to find her?
I had to find Veronica Eskridge.
Oh, Veronica.
So I did.
Did everything go okay this morning?
So far, I'm shaking like a leaf, but...
Oh.
Finding Veronica Eskridge was a lot easier than finding the film strip.
I'm nervous, too. I'm sweating a little bit.
I asked if I could interview her, and she was totally game. She was like, is it going to be taped or live?
And can I stream this later?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Clearly, this was not her first rodeo. She told me I could call her Ronnie.
Ah, I'm just so excited.
So Ronnie is a self-defense expert and has been a teacher her whole life. And she made the film strip based on her own research and experience. She wrote it, recorded it, everything. She made it for that Texas company, Educational Film Strips. And it was her authoritative film strip voice I heard on the tape that day in the library.
Practical personal defense for women.
She's retired now, and she lives in Ithaca, New York.
I got into a lot of trouble. I'll give you an example. I was teaching health in a small town called Chilhowee, Virginia, right near the border with Tennessee.
Over the course of our conversation, I find out that Ronnie is a total badass.
I got in trouble because I told the health class that men and women had the same number of bones in the skeleton. When everybody knows that God took one of the ribs out to make Eve, off I was to the principal's office.
She cares so much about empowering women by teaching them to protect themselves. Part of the reason she was so interested in women's self-defense was personal. It had to do with something that happened to her sister when they were young. Something really awful.
She came out of the bathroom and some guy had come in the back door, chased her down, and she started screaming at the top of her lungs. My father came out of his bedroom. Dad yelled and the guy took off running. And Dad ran after him and stopped in the back. And I said, Dad, why did you stop running? He said, I felt like a dog chasing a car. I don't know what I would have done if I'd caught him.
Wow.
And so Ronnie became a teacher. And back then, talking about women's safety wasn't always an easy thing, even with women. One time, she was teaching a class called Rape, Myths, and Reality.
For women only. That was the most difficult course I ever taught in my life. The hostility in that room of the women, they would say things like, my father is a lawyer, and he says women can't be raped because you can't stick a pen in a moving inkwell. Stuff like that.
It didn't shake her resolve. Ronnie was devoted to teaching women how to stay safe, whatever it took.
Absolutely, yes.
Like when to fight back.
No matter what they have to do it.
And when not to.
I don't want them to fight and get killed. I want them to stay alive.
And sometimes that meant offering unconventional advice to her students.
You know, things like if the guy's on top of you and you've got his testicles in your mouth or your hand, then you can fight. It takes about 8 pounds of pressure to pop a testicle. And he will not do anything to you. He'll be on the ground vomiting.
How do they know that? How do they know that it takes 8 pounds?
So by this point, Ronnie was pretty much my hero.
Wow.
But we still hadn't gotten to the big question, the whole point of the interview. All of a sudden, I was so nervous.
So now I'm going to shift gears.
I was so amped up to finally be talking to her.
I'm obsessed with the film strip, and this is a question I've been waiting to ask you for like 20 years.
Oh, my heavens.
I really, really didn't want to offend her. She's this amazing person who's done so much for women, and I didn't want her to think, hey, we think your life's work is hilarious.
So, excuse me.
But I also had to know. And of course, I was crazy to think that she would be offended or fazed by that, because obviously Ronnie is as tough as nails.
The most memorable part of the film strip to me is the part where it says that if you think you're being followed and you're sort of out of options, you should crash your car into the police station, not to the police station, but drive your car into the building.
Yes, I did that once.
You're kidding me.
No.
Oh my gosh, you have.
She did it. I had so many questions.
You have to tell me everything. You have to tell me everything.
Well, there were several of us that had gone out to a bar in Columbus, Ohio. And it was like 1 o'clock in the morning when we left. And we drove to an all-night diner to have chili, which is what we did in those days. We got back in the car and we're getting ready to go home. And these guys came out of the restaurant that we were in and started hassling us. We told them to get lost and we got in the car and they jumped in the car and followed us. And we drove all over God's creation trying to get rid of them and we couldn't. So I drove into the front of the police station.
Wow.
They didn't follow us.
So it worked.
Yes, it worked.
Wow.
So I drove up the stairs and in the door.
You're kidding me. What was that like?
I was scared feces less.
Did the doors shatter the second you touched them, or was it just like...
Yes.
How fast do you think you were going?
I slowed down, and it was upstairs. So I'm maybe going 10 or 15 miles an hour, maybe.
So were there people inside the building?
Oh, yeah. The police were really quite nice. They ran out and said, "What the hell is going on here?" But when we explained what was going on, they said, "Good job."
Wow.
Thank goodness I had insurance.
Now I understand why she did it and why she included it in the film strip. She was one of the only people teaching this stuff. So maybe some of her advice was a little unorthodox, but she was a pioneer in this field. She was blazing a trail. All she could do was teach what she knew. And what she knew was this. One time, when she was scared, she drove into a police station. And it kept her safe. There's a thing that happens every time I show this film strip to my friends. At first, we all start laughing about it and reminiscing. But then, at one point or another, the conversation shifts. And someone brings up the story of a time they were harassed, or followed, or even assaulted. It's not just our memory of the film strip that connects us. It's this shared experience of fear. Like my friend Natalie. She wasn't in high school with me, but I showed her the film strip. I showed it to everybody. And when I did, she reminded me of something that had happened to her in college. She was out drinking with friends, and after she had gone to bed, a guy we were friends with snuck into her dorm room. She woke up confused, to him assaulting her, touching her, taking off her clothes. When she reported it, he got kicked out of the dorms. And when people found out, some of them were mad at her about it. They felt bad for him. Somehow, she was the one who had done something wrong. And I couldn't even remember what my reaction had been. I thought I was so different from the students who had given Ronnie such a hard time in the 70s, but was I? Here I was, laughing at the advice in Ronnie's film strip. But we're still living in a world where a woman will get blamed for reporting someone who opens her door after she shut it. Before I found Ronnie, before I interviewed her, I'd Google things like 70s film strips, crash into a building, physical education. I was obsessed. Now I'm obsessed with stopping the kinds of people who made Ronnie crash her car into a building in the first place. This is the point when a normal person might stop. But I am not a normal person. And I know that now is the most important time to keep going. Ronnie's work is not done.
Caitlin Biljohn is a writer and artist living in Los Angeles. She produced that story along with Unfictional associate producer Carla Green, with sound mix and music by me. I'm Bob Carlson, and you're listening to Unfictional on KCRW. You can always subscribe to the Unfictional podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Plus, you'll find an archive of all our old programs at kcrw.com/unfictional. And today on the program, Running Away. And finally, a classic story of perseverance and running. It's the story of a marathon that was never supposed to be run, and one where everything that could possibly go wrong did. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
So about 16 years ago, I was in a really bad accident and I sustained tons of injuries, the worst of which by far was that all of the nerves in my left leg were crushed. And the doctors didn't expect me to be able to walk again.
And I was in the hospital and bedbound and paralyzed, and I would just stare at the toes on my left foot and will them to move. I was begging them to move. And then one day, I was just staring at my big toe, and it just kind of flickered so slightly. And I screamed, and all of the nurses ran in, and they were like, "Are you okay? What's going on?" And I was like, "I'm going to walk again." And I worked really hard, and I did a ton of physical therapy, and I got electroshock treatment on my leg to wake up the nerves, and that was really painful. And I had to dip my leg in a whirlpool for 20 minutes a day. And within 6 months, I was walking with a brace. And my knee had been shattered, and the doctor was like, "This is miraculous how well you've recovered. We totally didn't expect this. Just don't try to run." Well, I'm stubborn and determined, so I thought, that's it. I'm going to figure out how to run again. Although the again is kind of sort of this weird notion because I always hated running, but at this point I decided that running was my passion and I was going to need to be able to do it to be fulfilled in life. So with lots of strength training and yoga and more physical therapy, I built up enough muscle to go for my first very short run. And I did it. And I was airbound. And so I went back to my doctor and I was like, "Guess what? I went for a run." And he was like, "Again, like totally miraculous. This is really incredible. Just don't run a marathon." Well, a couple of years ago, I decided I was going to defy all odds and it was time for me to run a marathon. So I looked online for the most beautiful marathons in the United States, because if I was going to do this, I wanted to do it right. And then I found the Vermont City Marathon. Flat course along Lake Champlain, not too hot. I lived in New York at the time, so it was driving distance, and I started my training. My training involved waking up at 5 a.m. every morning, running in the freezing cold in January in New York on the icy roads and on icy bridges, near death all the time. And I would spend weekends running 16 to 20 miles a day, and I pretty much lost all of my friends, and I lost all of my body fat, and I was cross-training, and I was like, nothing is going to stop me now. 2 weeks before the race, I felt this terrible pain in my mouth, and I ran to the dentist. Something was terribly wrong. And he took one look at it, and he was like, "You know what? Your wisdom tooth is coming in." I was 35 at the time. "And it's infected, and there's a giant cyst on it, and it needs to be removed immediately." And I was like, no, you can't remove it immediately. I'm running a marathon in 2 weeks. I've been training for this." And he was like, "You know, if we do this surgery right now, you can run again in 10 days. And so we went for it, despite the fact that I didn't have dental insurance and couldn't afford the anesthesia. So I heard and felt everything, and my face blew up like a chipmunk. But after 10 days, I felt fine. I was ready to run again. And on that very day, I got a call from the Airbnb owner that I had booked, and she informed me that I couldn't stay in the Airbnb because her husband had just killed himself. And I was like, "Oh my God, that's terrible. Now where am I going to stay?" And there were no hotels available because the marathon is pretty much the biggest thing to hit Burlington each year. So I ended up having to camp several miles away from the start of the course. Now, I'm a city girl. I don't really know how to do this. I'd borrowed a tent from somebody. There was a hole in the roof of the tent. It was raining. I mean, I didn't get a wink of sleep all night. You have to wake up super early for marathons. And so I woke up and I called a cab to take me to the start of the race. And what arrived was a car that was literally duct taped together, and the driver had between 3 and 7 shoulder length white hairs like drizzling out of his head, and he told me how drunk he was still from the night before, and he kept turning around to make sure I could hear him, and there were 2 like tubular green snots connecting his nostrils with his upper lip, and it was so disgusting, and I was just like, what am I doing? But I get to the start of the race and I feel good again. Everyone's amped. There are people dressed up as nuns and as Darth Vader, and somebody's holding up a sign that says "Worst parade ever." And the gun shot off and my adrenaline was pumping, and I was like, "You know what? I don't know what I was so afraid of. It's like a beautiful flat course. The weather's perfect." And so I was just running along, And I noticed that I didn't see a lake and that I was running basically through warehouses and it looked like downtown LA or Williamsburg, New York. Then at one point I was running on a highway in a single file line as cars whizzed by, still no lake. And then I started to realize that the Vermont notion of flat is actually uphill. And I saw this stout woman with a see-through visor, and I can't even begin to understand why somebody would wear a see-through visor. It completely defies the purpose of a visor. But she was holding up this giant sign that in capital letters read, "Low health risk." By mile 10, still not beautiful at all. I'm starting to feel nauseous from all the uphill. It's getting a little bit hot. And there's that woman again holding up a sign that now says, "Moderate health risk." By mile 15, a heat wave had hit and we were in the mid 80s. People were hyperventilating. People were fainting onto the side of the road. EMS was being called. I heard sirens. People were kind of spinning off the course. And by mile 20, it must have been over 90 degrees. And I got to the bottom of what looked like a vertical hill that looked totally impossible. And there was that lady again, holding up a sign that said, "High health risk." So the wall that people talk about, that athletes talk about, is real. It just feels like your legs won't move anymore. And by mile 24, I didn't think I could go any further, and I thought I was truly going to have to crawl for the last 2.5 miles. And I was about to get onto the ground when suddenly the image of my paralyzed leg just flashed through my mind. And then my toe kind of moving very slightly. And then the naysaying doctors. And then training in the freezing cold. And my tooth. And my tent that had a leak in it. And my snot cab driver. And I just broke out into a sprint. And I ran so fast for the last 2 miles. And as I cross the finish line, they take a photo of you, and it is by far the worst photo of me ever taken, and it's online for anyone to be able to see. And I fell to the ground, and this woman fell next to me, and she was like, "I gave birth to twins, and one was Breach, and that was easier than this marathon." And everyone was like screaming about how this was the hardest marathon that they had ever run. And I started vomiting, and it was like projectile puke for like the next 3 to 4 hours. But I did it. So recently, a friend of mine asked if I wanted to run a 50-mile ultra marathon with her. And at first I was like, that is the craziest idea I've ever heard, and I think I have to friend dump you. But I've been thinking about it, and I'm kind of like, watch me.
Sarah Irving is the pseudonym for a storyteller and clinical psychologist living in Los Angeles. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. Special thanks this week to Kat Yor and Educational Film Strips in Huntsville, Texas. You can follow us on Twitter at Unfictional or like us on Facebook. And if you like the show, tell your friends about us. And I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.